War is mass murder. Conscription is slavery. Taxation is robbery. Murray Rothbard.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
So welcome back to another episode of Court is in Session. I am excited. We're excited to have our good friend Francois Delecto on after a while. Francois, thanks for coming back on.
Well, it's a pleasure to finally return, Court.
And Alec, as always, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's always a great time, Courtland. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So what's new in your life these days, Alex? Well, Alec, we'll start with you.
Nothing much. Just helping the people of Florida. Did some cooking today, did my meal prep, hanging out with my cat. Taking up golfing like a proper conservative. I am taking up golfing as the whitest sport imaginable.
It is pretty white, but I think polo is probably more white, or lacrosse maybe.
Lacrosse. I think polo is the whitest.
Polo is the whitest. I've never poloed before. I've never been that rich enough to do that. So
that's
fair. It's because you're Italian. You're just not quite white enough.
I'm not a WASP, so I'm not going to be invited to the polo outings.
Oh, that's right, because you're a Papist too.
Yeah, I guess as well.
And
Francois Delecto,
tell us about what you've been up to since we last heard from you.
Well, I've been on a bit of a trek, a cross-country road trip. I've done a large circle around the country, going from Atlanta, Georgia, through Tennessee, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Kansas, Colorado again. And now I'm in an undisclosed location at a Starbucks in Missouri.
Now, you've been dating 70-year-olds, last I heard, right?
That number has been greatly inflated by Joe Biden's economy. And the real inflation-adjusted number is 32.
32.
That was true for a while.
32-year-old man. How great.
Nah, that's a... unfortunately, another example of the fake news that we get these days in the inflated brand and economy. But it was a 32-year-old millennial woman who was extremely millennial and had sleeve tattoos and watched old French movies. But my dating life has since moved on, and I won't speak of the present. I'll only speak of the past. So I'll just say that moment is past, the 70-year-old woman moment. I mean, 32-year-old.
Okay. Moving on to an 80-year-old?
Yeah, essentially, sure. let's see. Last night at my, I stayed at an Airbnb hosted by a very kind woman named Patty, who was the most I don't know what the word for it is, most complex QAnon supporter I've ever heard. And she simply explained to me the way things really are and that Donald Trump is still our president. Joe Biden is a CGI projection. And that we've secretly been on the gold standard for a few years now.
Oh, that's great.
I know. I was really happy to find that out. And that she apparently in a few months, gas will go back down to 29 cents a gallon. And it'll be just like the 50s or the 70s. She couldn't really decide which.
Well, either way, I'd be happy to pay, $70 or $50 prices for gas.
Right, me too. And apparently all the three-letter agencies are unconstitutional. She calls them ABC agencies.
Well, that is true.
That's true.
That is true.
That's typical libertarian procedure.
Yeah. also, the world where we technically lost the Revolutionary War. She said that. The reason Trump was so rude to the Queen when he went to Buckingham Palace is because he forced her to sign a document that actually formally granted the United States its independence, because we've been a secret colony this whole time.
Oh my God.
And they really clamped down on us in 1871 after the Civil War, when this country was bankrupt. So the Rothschilds bought the country from Congress secretly and ran it through a shell corporation called USA Incorporated.
Why would they have to incorporate if they were just running a country?
The paper's got to be in order.
You got to have your paperwork in order.
Was it a Delaware corporation?
No, it was probably an S-Corp in Delaware. She didn't get into the particulars. But my best guess, that's why Joe Biden is our president, because this country is actually a corporation run out of Delaware.
That makes sense.
Wow.
Or it was until she also told me that apparently Donald Trump is still the president, and that on January 20th, 2021, we actually entered into martial law, but he's just been very quiet about it, so we didn't notice. Because it fits with his plan that CGI Brandon be perceived as the president for the time being until the next lockdown, when President Trump will air his 10-part documentary series on television and force all the liberals in lockdown to watch it. And then they'll see. After that, they'll import the med vets from Venus with the approval from the Galactic Federation, and they'll be able to reverse up to 30 years of aging.
Well, that sounds great.
Can that be... what's the term?
According to Patty, anyway, I cannot verify anything she told me, but that is all verbatim what I heard this morning.
I have no reason to doubt it.
I'm convinced.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds pretty good to me.
I've never met a person from Missouri before, but I'm going to guess this is one of their sanest inhabitants.
Yeah, I may have to agree with you there, Alec. I will add, one last piece of information from Patty. She did break down for me how the three branches of the global order were, segregated, sort of like our own constitutional government. The financial center is in Buckingham Palace. It's not the real queen. They killed all the royalty years ago, and it's like the fake financial queen they use as a prop, who is also actually secretly running the whole thing. All the furniture isn't there anymore either. I don't know what they did with it, but she did insist the furniture's gone. Obviously, the military is based out of Washington, D.C., but also at the same time, the Pentagon is working with Trump to track down the satanic pedophiles. Actually, she never told me the third branch. She just said there was one.
So it's not enough that they're pedophiles. It's they're satanic as well. Like they're just bad people.
She definitely said satanic more often than pedophiles. So she's pretty sure they're satanic.
Well, I think they're Satanists first, and then the pedophilia is a natural
right.
Result.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of like a side thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Just kind of
It's just that part's incidental.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Like.
Well,
George Bush would wear a cowboy hat because he wanted to look like he was from Texas, not because he didn't live in Texas because he wanted to wear a cowboy hat. It's kind of like that.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, how are you, Court? What have you been up to?
Man, well, nothing that great. I've just been working a lot, and that's been about it. It's been a really relaxing summer. Going to Oklahoma City tomorrow to do stuff with the ACU, so that's going to be fun. I always enjoy a good work trip. Kind of breaks up the monotony a little bit, and nothing too crazy.
You mentioned this to me earlier, Court, and I don't think we had filmed an episode since you told me, but you had recently finished your 10-year-long journey to read The Fountainhead.
That's right. I did finally finish.
10 years? When did you start it?
It did not take 10 years, but it took several months to read the book because I started it in law school, probably close to a year ago, unfortunately, and I just, for one reason or another, I could never get back into it. But this summer, I decided I'm going to read more, and that was the first thing I did was finish that book. So I read that, and I finally finished it, and it really is just an incredible book. And
in your defense, Cortland, it also literally took me about 12 or 13 months to read it, and I agree, like the ending was worth it, but like also I'd say the first 70% of the book is just a slog.
It's a sloggy book, but it's fantastic for sure.
It picks up for sure, but
Yeah.
The first part is just been... so.
Yeah.
You read it. You know what it is.
I didn't know that you had read it.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I read it freshman year.
Oh, damn. Wow. So wait, freshman year of college?
No, freshman year of elementary school. Yes, freshman year of college.
Fuck. All right. Because I would have been shocked because I didn't read it until my 10th grade of high school.
Oh, wow. Your sophomore. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would have been shocked if you had read it freshman year.
I guess I did. Well, depending on how fast you read it, you may have finished it before me. Because I started it freshman year and I finished it sometime or very early sophomore year. Wait, no. No, I definitely finished it when I was still living in Sally dorm. So I guess I finished it at the end of freshman year. I can't quite remember when I started it though.
And it's funny because I read some, John Calvin, but now I'm reading a book by Peter Kropotkin, who I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he's an anarcho-communist.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, good for him.
And I'm reading his book called The Conquest of Bread. And it's just the most high level drivel I've ever read in my life. Like, it's just him complaining about everybody's got all this money and I can't have any. It's no depth to it at all, but it's supposed to be his grand philosophical work, and it's just drivel. So it's quite a turn from Ayn Rand. And it's also 100 pages double spaced.
Is it double spaced, really?
It's not double spaced, but the font's really big, and there's it's very.
So it's written to appeal to children.
I don't think so. I think it's just written to communists. So,
that reminds me. You guys ever heard of that debate about whether Stalin was really in his heart a communist or not? And there's two really ruling camps of leftists, the ones that want to disown him and the ones that want to defend him.
I've heard the tankies and the tankies.
Yeah. But there's also the side that's I mean, obviously there's tankies, but there's also people who are no, he wasn't.
Wasn't a communist. I thought you were going to say people were saying that Stalin wasn't a tankie.
A tankie is someone who supports Stalin, so I guess Stalin wasn't a tankie. He was just surrounded by them.
Okay. So is Mao.
Because by definition, a tankie is someone who defends Stalin and Mao.
Yeah.
So therefore, Stalin and Mao themselves were not.
They're the stereotypical...
Kind of like how Christ is not a Christian. He's the Christ.
Right.
Okay. I thought tankies didn't really have to do with that. I thought it was more than just going to war. So I would have thought that Dick Cheney was a tankie.
That may be the broader definition, but the colloquial modern internet definition, I would say, is just the specific variety of internet Marxist who will go to bat for Stalin or Mao. They never did anything wrong and will do absolutely anything they can to criticize Western imperialism, despite how bad any other system might be. That's the Twitter definition of tanky as of right now.
It's the people with the,
In a more old and broader sense, you may be right, Portland.
Yeah. Although it is funny, the thought of Dick Cheney being a secret Stalinist.
I did see years ago, I did see a really great meme that said more and more I'm attracted to anarcho neoconservatism. There was this tweet under it about explaining Cheney Leninism. It's as capitalist Leninists, we believe we have to, destroy other countries so that we can build them up so that they can have the revolution or something. I don't know. I can't remember.
It was just a parody item.
It was all bullshit, but it made me laugh when I saw it. Just because anarcho neoconservatism is the final form of just put anarcho in front of something and it becomes cool.
Yeah, that's true. That is a great one. I follow a Twitter account that is a bot that just posts anarcho something. And there's been some gold mines. There was a bunch of likes for the one that was anarcho-communism because it went up essentially. It went up eventually. And then there was a bunch of comments for anarcho-capitalism saying that it was cringe or not real anarchism.
I saw some guy who called himself an anarcho-monarchist.
Oh, that is the most correct position. That's Hoppe. That's Hans Rim and Hoppe, essentially.
Yeah. It's arguably Tolkien's position. Yeah, it's arguably Tolkien's philosophy too, based on this a couple of letters that have been unearthed between him to his son.
Yeah. And then it's Tolstoy's position as well, for anarcho-monarchism, because he was an anarcho-Christian and Christ is king. So it would be in Christ's kingdom.
So for those listening, the way I understand anarcho-monarchism is you have a monarch, right? But this king's only real position is making sure that the country remains anarchist. So, like, to just hold back those who want to seize the control of government. And if you guys have a better explanation than that, that's how I understand anarcho-monarchism.
Well, I'll just say I've never seen a and obviously you can't have, like, a widely accepted universal definition of anarcho-monarchism. I'll just give you my loose understanding of, say, Tolkien's perspective, because that's the one I'm most familiar with, which is that the idea is you have a king who is just supremely disinterested in the affairs of state. And the way he phrased it was, give me a king whose greatest interest is like model trains or something. I'm paraphrasing. That's basically what he said. And so that only like in the most extreme crises, when like centralized power is actually needed, would he be moved to actually do anything. And the rest of the time, everyone would just be kind of left alone.
Yeah.
And
my definition is also a little bit different from that. My definition would be in anarcho-monarchism, we essentially live in like a giant fiefdom where like there one guy owns all of the land and his family is a little bit like a company, but is mostly just him and then his offspring. And then they have a general interest to keep things well because they own all of it. So it's important to them.
And there you have the distinction between the Tolkien anarcho-monarchism and say Hoppian anarcho-monarchism. Yeah.
But honestly, what I find fascinating about it, and I would never, ever call myself an anarcho-monarchist, but it's an interesting proposition, is it really does have a way of filling the vacuum of power, which is one of the main issues that people will bring up with anarchism. At least my professor, Randy Holcomb, has said, like, he would call himself an anarchist, except that it leaves his power vacuum. So, like, an anarcho-monarchist would fill the vacuum of power, yet still allow people to trade and live without the interference of the state, which I think is, you know, an interesting proposition.
Certainly, we could imagine perhaps like a kind of textbook anarcho-monarchist who would, in maybe the Tolkien tradition, who'd be just so disinterested in everything that he only was moved to take action when he saw like another form of authority rising up, and then would use the forces of his, let's not say state, let's say realm, to smash that other burgeoning power center, and then that would pretty much be the sole purpose of the kingship, yeah. Functionally.
And then go back to playing with model trains.
And then exactly. From the Hoppian anarcho-monarchism perspective, it would be that the main guy would have an interest in making sure that prosperity is happening, trade is happening, because he has a financial interest in making sure that things are okay. And if people are worried about environmental degradation, he also has an interest to keep his lands because he owns them in good condition. And his role would become in the system of Tolkien, his role would become most apparent in any time of conflict, because he would have to take action at that point, because this would be something that affects him directly and affects his kingdom directly.
And you could say that these two definitions are like not even at odds with each other, because by the so disinterested that he only acts in emergencies position, you could argue that a rational being would be like would still give enough attention to facilitate trade and, you know, to be a good steward of the land, etc., and everything that Alec just said.
And essentially it's no different for, you know, kind of my first thought when you were talking, Alec, is like he owns all the land. It's like, because I'm a big fan of private property, but really, in what country is there private property? Even in the United States, where we have some of the best private property rights in the world, we're still subject to eminent domain, which is, you know, at the end of the day, who owns us all is the state. Right. And it'd be, you know, the same thing.
Right. You could even argue it's just a more honest version of what we already have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you could also, like, I also imagine that this would be my anarcho-monarchism wouldn't be an anarcho-monarchism covering the whole of the United States. It would be, you know, like maybe the state of Florida at most is the size of one kingdom. And, but then outside that kingdom, you might just also be in just unincorporated territory. So you could theoretically live in the wilderness by yourself if you didn't want to be part of any system. You don't even have that option now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting stuff. And that wasn't what we were planning on talking about, but that was a really great little conversation that sprung up.
Yeah, it's a great example of how versatile this podcast can be.
That's what I think. Yeah. It really brings out the best in us. But so I do want to talk. One thing I do want to talk about is, I think there have been rumors and rumblings about what's going to happen in 2024 as far as the Republican primary is concerned. I've heard a lot of people talking about Trump. I've heard a lot of people talking about how am I forgetting my governor's name here in Virginia?
Youngkin.
Youngkin, duh. I've even heard people talking about him running for president, even though he's been governor for only a few months.
I think we can be sure that's a regional thing, because I certainly haven't heard anything about that. But I have heard about DeSantis in every state I've traveled to.
Really?
Yes, and you're absolutely. When people know I'm from Florida, people bring him up one way or the other.
That's so big.
Yeah, I bet the opinions about him seem to be pretty strong.
Better
that's
than
true. One way or the other.
One way or the other.
And it's interesting that it's not Abbott. You know, you could theoretically think that maybe they cover a lot of the same territory. They take a lot of the same action, but nobody talks about Greg Abbott the way that they talk about DeSantis.
Nobody really does. And I don't understand why. He's reliable.
Greg doesn't have the charisma that Ron does.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I think it's also like he deals with, there's so much flack regarding the border issue.
Mm-hmm.
And Texas has to deal with a lot of that. And so I feel like that's an issue where no matter what position you take, you're upsetting the majority of people. And that's something that DeSantis doesn't have to worry about at all, really, or just at least as much as Abbott does.
I'd also say that Ron is more handsome than Greg.
Ron is a Chad. I mean, flat out.
Oh, for sure. And his wife's gorgeous.
That's true.
That's true. And she just beat breast cancer.
She did just beat breast cancer.
Nothing but wins down in the Sunshine State.
Yeah, bunch of W's.
So what do we think about him as a potential candidate in 2024? Like, I've heard people talking about, because honestly, the conventional wisdom that I've kind of heard and have kind of thought was that, well, if Donald Trump runs in 24, there's no way that DeSantis is going to run. But I think the problem with that is I think you can only carry on this kind of political excitement surrounding a figure for so long, because either DeSantis is going to screw up or people are just going to get tired of him. And also, it seems that DeSantis has really been trying to expand his scope past the state of Florida. You know, I've heard he's been running ads in like Iowa and stuff like that. So what do you all think? Do you think he's going to run, or what are you all thinking?
Well, if he's running those ads, I'm sure he intends to run. And I would say they're effective, because I did read it, and I believe it was in The Hill, a recent poll. I think it was one of those Harvard slash whatever their partner is polls, that he was actually beating Trump by a few points in a New Hampshire primary poll, and he was tied in an Iowa caucus poll, which is very significant, considering that and a few months ago, like the traditional perspective was that DeSantis is everyone's second choice, but only Florida's first choice. But that seems to be changing pretty quickly.
Yeah. Plus, those are the first ones. So if you get big wins in Iowa and New Hampshire, then that tends to give you some momentum going in other states.
Exactly. Precisely.
And I guess I've been the most consistent Florida resident recently. So I'm dealing with people every day that are under his supreme
reign.
Rule. Yeah. And and I just can't imagine, like, even like people that don't like the rest of him, they still usually talk about COVID at some point. Yeah. And they talk about how they don't have to, you know, it's just like, oh, they don't have to worry. They don't even have to think about it. But when you bring up, oh, they went on a recent travel to another state and they have more restrictive things over there, then they bring it up. Or if you bring it up, it's just immediate conversation of nobody really has that negative of a view towards it. Maybe they'll have a negative view when he goes off about masks or whatever, but they're at least very happy that they don't live in a state that has strong restrictions.
Really? I have personally spoken to a number of pretty moderate people who like maybe were very lukewarm or even negative about DeSantis before, but I've also heard when given a few beers, I've heard them say things to the effect of, you know, in hindsight, Florida was the best place to live during this pandemic. And everything else aside, I'll probably vote for him again, at least this November in 2022. I've heard that from two or three people in my hometown.
Now, we have to remember that before COVID, his poll numbers were like the high 60s in the approval ratings, or like low 70s. He had super high approval even before this whole thing happened.
Yeah. And then they dipped because of COVID. Like, I don't think they're as high as they were then, but he's developed a cult following. I don't know his poll numbers, but I don't think they're in the 70s like they were.
No, so I mean, I guess I'm trying. Yeah, I'll try and look it up right now. Or Francois can. He was the first major candidate that I ever voted for.
Really?
Yeah, because when I moved here to Florida, by the time that I had moved from New York, I hadn't been able to vote yet. So I get here, and then the first major election that happens is the 2018 election. And that's when I had turned 18 years old that July. And so then 2018 midterms, and I vote for DeSantis and Rick Scott.
You didn't vote for Bob White?
Well, I voted for Bob White in the primary.
Right.
But not in the general. I didn't write in. I wasn't that principled yet. Cannot write in Bob White.
All right. According to this poll from February, conducted by the University of North Florida, Ron has a 55% approval rating and a 38% disapproval rating, which is a pretty good gap of lukewarm people that you could probably rely on given a poor candidate on the Democratic side.
Yeah, a Charlie Crist.
Yeah, actually, a fun little fact I read in the New Yorker just yesterday was that, did you know that during the pandemic, the Florida Democratic Party had to apply for one of those federal small business loans or something? No. Because that is simply how enfeebled the apparatus of the Democratic Party in Florida is.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe all the major gubernatorial candidates combined, like the money they've raised so far, is like a bit of Ron's war chest.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you talk to people, Democrats down here, they even seem to recognize that this party is like in shambles in this state.
They shit on it all the time.
And the old, it was the old Dems building in downtown Tallahassee. They had a party building. It was that shell that Bloomberg set up his temporary race in when he was running for president.
Wow.
If Francois and I got to visit that office.
Yeah, in the golden days of Wealthy Mike.
Wealthy Mike, trying to get a job. I was trying to network.
Yeah. Basically, it was funny. I think the guy there basically told us like he had no qualifications. They were just hard, but when he first got there, they were just so desperate to hire people, they just literally threw money at him.
Yes, that's why.
But we had missed the cheese wagon, as it were.
Yeah, because I think it was like maybe a month or two, and then he dropped out.
Yeah,
yeah. They probably got paid well too.
Yeah, they definitely did. Well, my favorite thing, the thing that I liked so much about it was that he was just stealing people from other campaigns. So like the other campaigns that were actually trying to win were losing all of their top talent because Bloomberg would just pay them like $200,000 to come over and do their crap.
That's awesome. That's so based.
And then these parties, like there started to be news reports coming out about these campaigns being really mad because he's stealing their people.
Oh, man.
It does remind me.
What does it remind you of, Francois?
Oh, I was just thinking that didn't a few weeks ago Elon Musk more or less endorse Ron?
No, he did. Joe Rogan. Oh, wait.
Both of them did.
Oh, they both did. Okay.
That's a major W for getting in, like, you know, unregistered or independently registered middle-aged white guys.
Yes, and like tech bros.
Yeah. I think that's a class of people that's needed to be courted for a while. I think Trump kind of had that a little bit and didn't realize it in 2016. And I think he lost a lot of it in 2020, and that's why he lost. But those are the people.
I was simply going to interject that I do recall the only demographic group that significantly statistically moved away from Trump between 2016 and 2020 was like middle-aged white men. Like there was a 5 percentage point shift.
Yeah, he definitely lost it in 2020. But I think that's a group of people that have more power than people realize. Like that's the GameStop short squeeze people. Like I don't know. I think they've got. I think they're a sleeping bear that if you can get somebody excited about them, could do well. And having Elon Musk, you know, the king of the middle-aged white guys, you know, and Joe Rogan, you know, talk about it, you know, with elk meat in between his teeth. Like, I think that's helpful.
Yeah, certainly, certainly.
So what do we think? Do we think if the primary were going on? Oh, sorry.
I'm in favor of DeSantis setting up a new Augustus Imperium in the state of Florida first, and then moving it out to the rest of the country. I want a new Roman Empire, and DeSantis is the Italian Chad that can achieve that.
Very based. Very based. Do you think he beats Trump in a primary? Because I think Trump more or less is the establishment these days.
I think it would be a very tough fight, and I really think it would come down to a coin flip. If primary season began today, as things stand, I think it would come down to a coin flip, because Ron does have a significant lead in three very important early states. He's tied in Iowa, he's ahead in New Hampshire, he's ahead in Florida, and I think the only the third state to hold primaries, I believe, is South Carolina, and I don't know how he's doing there, but that would give him a lot of momentum if the primary season launched right now.
I wouldn't be surprised if Trump was in the lead in polls in South Carolina.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
I wouldn't be
me.
Surprised either. Yeah.
But then again, Trump. There's a lot of sable palms in South Carolina, and there's a lot of sable palms in Florida.
Mm. Whoa.
Whoa.
Make of that what you will.
Those are like the bombs that DeSantis has planted in South Carolina.
Wow, he's been at this for a while then.
Yeah. I mean, from what I can gather, he was like the kind of kid in college who like wanted to be president. Like he worked two jobs, was captain of the baseball team, and had like really good grades. Like he was just like kind of, you know, sort of a working class Ivy League Chad. That was like it's more or less what I can understand about his days at Yale.
It became like at the College Republicans chapter, it became like a sticking point with the primary that he was in against Adam Putnam, which was like this just other moderate, middle of the road type of Republican from the state of Florida. And DeSantis was this more Trump person out of the two.
Yeah.
And those were back and forth, I think, throughout the whole primary season.
Well, he really pulled away, though, at the end, though.
He did.
Well, that was because of the Trump endorsement. That you can't discount that. I was looking back at our old group chat not too terribly long ago, but I remember when Trump endorsed Ron DeSantis, I put in our group chat, I think you were in this, Alec, like, who is this DeSantis guy? And everybody's like, I don't know, I've never heard of him.
He was my hometown congressman, so I knew who he was. Oh, I was in a Ron, I knew about Ron before he was cool.
Wasn't he only a rep for like a couple of years?
He was elected in 2012. Actually, in his first campaign, the debate was held in my high school auditorium, although a year before I got there.
Wow.
In fact, if you want, you can find that video on YouTube. And it's not that impressive. It's just him in my high school auditorium. But
did you vote for DeSantis in the general?
Yes, I did. Wow. In 18?
Yes, in 18.
Yeah.
Court, you voted for Gillum, I'm assuming?
Right, yes, of course.
Did you guys vote in that primary cycle?
Yeah, I did
vote in that primary cycle. I voted for Adam Putnam.
I voted for Bob White.
I did vote for Adam Putnam. I didn't want to vote for somebody just because they were a Trump endorsed person, and it seemed like that's where that was going in the primary.
You were a never Trumper back then.
I've never been a never Trumper. I was probably more of a Trump fan then than I am now. I've always liked Donald Trump, but I'm not the type of person to vote for somebody just because Trump endorsed him. And at the time, I didn't really see anything I liked Ron DeSantis. And Adam Putnam, he would have been a good governor. I mean, he had been in Florida for a long time. You know, he did a good job.
I think he would have been worse on COVID than DeSantis.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying he would have been a good governor. DeSantis has proven to be a better governor than Adam Putnam could have been, for sure.
He still has a sign up. He still has a billboard up on 75.
That sign is still up?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. That is a funny sign.
Is the sign still up of the person who ran against Matt Caldwell? Who
yeah, Ashley Moody. I think that's gone Ashley. Now. I think it's gone finally. But the Putnam one's still there.
Well, you know, that's cool. Glad somebody's paying a lot of money to keep that up.
So in the primary, is it just going to be Trump and DeSantis, or are there going to be other people? Because no matter who those other people are, they're never going to beat one of those two.
Right. Larry Hogan's 100% going to run.
Ugh.
It will depend on if Trump does decide to not run, then DeSantis will become the front runner, and then but everyone else will try to take him down. Like I think Cruz will run again, and a few other people will jump in the race.
I can't imagine Trump not running.
I can. I think.
Yeah, me too.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's. I don't know what it would take, but I think he just reach a point where he's like, you know what? Do I want to do all this again? No, I just don't. I want to stay in my castle in Florida, and literally just vibe.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he liked being president. I think he liked having the title and getting the attention. But I think like the day to day, from what I've read, he clearly did not enjoy it.
I'd agree with that as well.
Like, I think the late Norm Macdonald said, I don't think this, he said this back in 2016, but I think it remains true. Donald Trump does not want to be president. He wants to be president of whatever room he is in. So it's just like that central feature of his personality. It carried him all the way to the White House, just like trying to dominate whatever room he is in, led him to the top of the country for a moment.
It's fair. Do you think if he wins the primary, he wins the general again?
Against who? Against Biden? Strong chance. Against Kamala? Absolutely. And I don't know. I'd give that. I won't give a general answer on that. I'll have to do it candidate by candidate.
Do you think Kamala has worse chances than Biden?
Oh, absolutely. People hate her. Like I know people who like are diehard progressive liberals, queer people, like college age girls who absolutely hate her. And there's a strong chance they might sit that out even. And that's like one of the core demographics of the Democratic Party.
Is it because they view her as phony? Because that's mostly what I view her as.
It's usually a cocktail of things. People view her as phony. People still are mad at her for like her time as attorney general in California. She's very bad at speaking in interviews, and she just seems like, you know, kind of a wet noodle.
Yeah. She talks down to people and says just absolutely incoherent nonsense in a way that just like, again, talking down. It's really interesting. It's a really interesting dynamic that she's able to pull off.
It's difficult to find redeeming qualities in her for like anyone. Like what people I hear defend her are wealthy middle-aged white women who are like, I'm glad there's finally a woman vice president. Like that is her only saving grace. Only applies to a few people.
And I think that's going to be her lasting legacy. Her legacy is going to be preventing other women from being vice president.
Yeah.
Because people are going to be so uninterested in seeing that after seeing her performance.
That's a strong possibility.
One of my favorite little factoids. I think it's still true. I haven't looked at the polling for a while, but I know it was true for a while. The day after Dick Cheney got drunk and shot that dude in the face, his approval rating as vice president was higher than Kamala Harris's is now.
That tells us everything we need to know, Court. That's a great point.
Yeah. Well, I think I said this before, that's an aesthetic.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there is a Cheney shoot someone core, as there is cottage core, and there's a knight core. There is Cheney shoot someone in the face core.
Yeah,
that's fair.
There's no Kamala core.
There's an Americana to it.
Yeah, I agree with you.
There's nothing. There's nothing to Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
Like, what was that quote they used to share for her? It was, Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking from a Mike Pence debate. Like, that was, like, her only moment. So they milked that for all it could. Because, like, clearly that had some power for certain large parts of the electorate. And, like, you know, perhaps I could be sympathetic to it in some contexts. But that's really all she had going for her, was that there's finally a woman here. That was really her entire platform. Like, not platform, but, like, that was her brand. And it's just not enough to carry her forward past where she is already.
Yeah. I also think that it's not tough to beat Mike Pence in a debate.
Yeah, that there's also that. And plus, there was that fly on his head, and that was just kind of weird.
Mike Pence did wipe the floor with Tim Kaine, though, if you remember that. He was an excellent debater.
But Tim Kaine's a dork.
Oh, yeah.
You know, say what you will about Kamala, like, at least, you know, there's, like, something there, like, you mostly it's something to hate, but, like, there's, like, a presence there. Tim Kaine is just, like, he's, like, someone who would have gotten shoved into a locker if he was, like, a student in a high school in the 50s.
Isn't he a senator from Virginia now?
Yeah.
Yeah. He has been for a while.
And he's a dork.
I had a friend who interned for Tim Kaine a few years back. While he was running for vice president. And when he was rallying the troops, he's like, the persona that I want to put off is I want people to think of me as America's stepdad.
Oh.
what an inspiring pitch.
That's a fetish. He has a fetish.
You think that's a fetish?
Yeah.
I have no idea what that means. It's like, if that's what he was going for, like, looking back, good for him. He nailed it, I guess. Damn.
What if it becomes a scandal that Hillary cucked Bill with Tim Kaine?
Oh,
I feel like Bill got around so many times that he'd still be up in the score.
Oh, 100%, 100%.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that just would be like kind of a funny little weekend story, and we would all just leave it at that.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because after all, Bill is a Leo.
Well, right.
What is DeSantis?
He's a Virgo, actually.
Hmm.
Oh.
So what does that mean?
How do you see
that exemplifying him?
Well, he's known for having, like, a strong work ethic and being very organized, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is, like, a sort of a hallmark Virgo trait, not to lean too much on astrology, but, like, you know how John Mulaney, like, kind of seems like an anxious but heart, like, his on his school side he was, like, very professional and hardworking despite all his party shit, right, in his stories,
right. Mm.
To refer to a popular culture figure, John Mulaney is also a Virgo, and if you look at, like, Virgo figures, there usually is this, like, strong streak of, like, having, like, an organized work ethic despite everything else going on in your life, even if it's falling apart, that, like, when it comes to the thing you're working on, you do it very fastidiously and with gumption. And I think you see that in Ron.
Damn.
Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. I mean, when his wife had breast cancer, he was still around the country really well.
The state.
The state really well. Sorry.
Well, Freudian slip
there. Florida's a country. Can we just say that?
It's got more.
What's the slogan? Make America Florida?
Yeah, make America Florida. I've actually seen people, like, wearing hats, not hats, shirts, with that on.
Right. I do kind of want that hat, but I would only wear it out of state.
It's like a warning. So you guys said Larry Hogan, Ted Cruz. I'm kind of surprised by Ted Cruz, to be honest.
I think Ted Cruz just wants it so bad. As long as he thinks there's, like, a chance in hell, he'll do it. So, like, he knows he can't beat Trump, but I think he'd be like, fuck it, may as well try against anyone else.
Yeah. Do you think Rand Paul runs again?
No. No.
If he does, it will be such a trash fire.
I wish, but he's not going to run. He's been doing a pretty good job in the Senate.
Rand?
Yeah, Rand.
Do you wish Rand would run?
Yeah, I want Rand to be president. He's not going to be president, so I don't
think he's a good... You realize this is Rand Paul, not Ayn Rand, right?
Yes. Yes, Rand Paul, the son of Ron Paul. Yes, I know who I'm talking about.
I know, I was just teasing.
Oh, sorry.
The Rand Paul campaign is the first political campaign I ever donated money to.
Really? Wow.
Big Rand Paul guy. Yeah, yeah.
Mine was the Andrew Yang campaign.
Mine was Tulsi Gabbard.
Really?
Yep. I'll always wear that with pride. Just like
actually, you know what? I think I did give $5 to Tulsi also. I can't remember if I did that before or after my $10 to Yang.
Mm.
I do love Tulsi Gabbard.
I still have her bumper sticker on my car.
I have. So when she was at CPAC, they took this awesome picture of her, and it's her in the foreground, like, you know, speaking in front of the CPAC lectern, and behind her is like this, because she was speaking at the Ronald Reagan dinner, this big like picture of Ronald Reagan, and it's just awesome. And I printed that up, and I now have it on my desk at work. It's one of my favorite pictures. I'll send it to y'all. It's beautiful.
Yes, please please forward that.
So I want her to run, so that'll be good.
DeSantis Gabbard.
That's it. That's it. Like, how is that not the most ideal ticket?
Or I would also settle for her being Secretary of State.
You just got me like, so excited, yeah. Francois.
She would be such a, but yeah, that would be the ticket.
100%. I would. That would be the first campaign I would work on. I would quit my job to go work on that campaign.
I'll tell you my ideal presidential ticket and administration. It would be like a Sanders Romney ticket where Ron DeSantis would be the chief of staff. Tulsi Gabbard would be like Secretary of the Interior. Let's see. Dick Cheney would be Secretary of Defense again. And the Secretary of Education would be my eighth grade language arts teacher, Mr. Finkel.
Okay. Awesome. What about energy?
Energy? Let's give Rex Tillerson one more shot. No. Actually, I know he was Secretary of State, but maybe he would have done better if he was in energy. Sanders would have to pardon one of the Enron guys and then let them run the energy department.
Oh my God.
Because like that's really what it would take to get the price of gas back under control. If we're going for that 29 cents that Patty told us about. I think Trump should be Secretary of State.
Not press.
Oh, he could do both. He could do both. Yeah, so that's my ideal presidential.
Why? Well, so I'm kind of surprised by putting Sanders over Romney.
I think you have AOC running the Fed too, by the way.
No, that's ridiculous.
No. I put Ron Paul in charge of the Fed. AOC would be the Commerce Secretary. So yeah, that's the administration I'm pitching to people.
Damn. But why Sanders over Romney?
It's just something rich.
I just think Mitt Romney has like more VP vibes. Like you just send him to a funeral. Like that's kind of his. That's kind of where he is in his life.
Great endorsement.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think he'd be very good at it. He's polite. He's well dressed. He's an old man. Like he would be a very good vice president.
Damn, I think that puts the DeSantis Gabbard ticket to shame.
Yeah. I think so too. Yeah, it's not even close.
Yeah, and of course he'd be right there. He'd be the chief of staff, so he could be in line for the DeSantis Warren administration after that.
DeSantis Warren? Oh my God!
I just said that as a joke, but
right. Oh, you weren't joking with that.
No. The other one I was absolutely serious. DeSantis for Romney with Cheney at defense. Trump as Secretary of State, part. AOC Flash. At Commerce, Ron Paul at the Fed. And I don't know. What more could you ask for?
I do like the Secretary of State / Press Secretary kind of dual role for Trump. I think he would thrive.
I think he would thrive.
Is the Press Secretary considered a cabinet position?
No.
No, because they don't have to get approved.
Yeah. Okay. It's part of just like the president's little gang of positions he can create and destroy at whim. Mm. Like technically, Chief of Staff was like created by the Nixon administration, and then Gerald Ford, because of the Nixon legacy, wanted to not have one. And then like Dick Cheney just kind of like made him have one until eventually Dick Cheney was the Chief of Staff.
So based.
Like you've probably heard this story, but when Gerald Ford took office, he said he wanted to be like his the people working in the White House to be like spokes on a bicycle wheel, and he was like at the center, so everyone had equal access to him. And then we're leaving the White House. One of Cheney's secretaries, like as a gift, gave him a bicycle wheel, but all the spokes except one were broken. And that was like that was like the Cheney story in the Ford administration.
Oh, geez,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Damn. So Cheney was a killer back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually started out there was a dual role between him and Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld was like kind of the functional chief of staff before Cheney, but then Ford sent him out to run defense, and so Cheney kind of like stayed behind and held the fort in the White House. And between the two of them, they kind of were a strong arc of power within the Gerald Ford administration.
Jesus Christ. That's horrifying. Were they neocons back in the day? Was a neocon a thing at that point?
I would, you know, Cheney is an interesting figure because I don't think he's really a neocon. He just has neocon foreign policies. I think like if you look at his voting record, like he is extremely just like, you know, arguably Freedom Caucus conservative, with the exception of his NSA views and his foreign policy views. Like he voted against like basically every variety of civil rights legislation that came up when he was in Congress. And he was extremely, he tried to stop President Reagan's ban on machine guns or assault weapons or whatever it was, and that came through in 84.
So this is a me question then. What is a neocon? Because I always thought a neocon as that's mostly a foreign policy thing.
Right.
Patriot Act stuff.
If you look deep into it, neoconservatives as an intellectual movement is more like 60s liberals who became very disillusioned with all the hippie shit, and so then they became
Russian communists.
Yes, there's that too, like people like Bill Kristol and like Paul Wolfowitz.
Yeah,
people who like end up having the same foreign policy views as say a Cheney figure, but maybe not with the nuance of their more
they also tend to be not as right wing on domestic issues.
Like, yeah,
they're not very conservative on domestic issues.
They're basically just liberals without like the preachiness, and also really want to invade Iraq a lot.
So I mean,
that's the short definition.
This sounds very Nixonian. Would that be a fair characterization?
No, I don't think I'd call Nixon a neocon.
Because Nixon, I think, had very deep strains of social conservatism that weren't like ideological, but were maybe just more of a product of who he was and where he grew up, that I think a lot of neoconservatives, like say Bill Kristol, wouldn't observe, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's certainly a Venn diagram there, but it's not a circle, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But like a lot of neoconservatism is defined by the actions that they've taken in the 90s and 2000s. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to try and apply it to way back when, before those events had taken place.
Okay.
Yes.
Like what would neoconservatism look like if 9/11 didn't happen?
Right. Yeah. I think someone, this might not be correct, but someone described once that neoconservatism is like that kind of view that America really isn't a place, it's an idea.
Yes.
And that's like, and so which I think is at odds with a lot of, say, Cheney's views, or especially Nixon's views, or really a lot, or Reagan's views, like that, which I think have a bit more of a nationalist with a lowercase n tint, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that completely.
Whereas neoconservatism is sort of trying to wants to create
a constant export.
A world of a little Americas, kind of, yeah. So that, you know, multinational corporations can just run around and do as they wish.
Yeah. They're also like, they're liberal in terms of economics as well.
Yeah. They're like a liberal who would be CEO of a corporation who also wants to bomb Iraq.
Yeah. Really wants to bomb Iraq.
Yeah. And like, that's where Cheney comes in, because he also really wanted to bomb Iraq, but for like, I think completely separate reasons.
But he was also the CEO of a corporation.
And those are the separate reasons. I think his reasons were really rooted in his Halliburton stock bonuses.
Fair.
Like, you know, I think if you really look into the situation with those no bid contracts and stuff, there's nothing on paper, but it's very clear there was like an understanding there between him and his former community.
Yeah. Do you think Bill Kristol has ever hunted? Bill Kristol would not. Bill, that's the problem with Bill Kristol, is he would not shoot a friend of his in the face.
Yeah, see, that's why Bill Kristol is a neoconservative and Dick Cheney's not. Dick
Cheney's 100%. 100%.
And I know that sounds strange, because I think Dick Cheney is often considered the quintessential neoconservative, but I do consider that to be a misconception.
Hmm. Okay. And you do know Dick Cheney more than anybody that I know. Better than anybody I know.
Is the Vice movie worth watching?
It's fine. Like, it's not great, but if you have nothing else to do, I'll put it on. Parts of it are entertaining. Christian Bale gives an excellent performance. Amy Adams does all right. Steve Carell is not good, but he was just miscast. It's not his fault.
Yeah, I thought the movie as a movie was fantastic. I've actually seen it 3 times. People try to act like it's historical. It's not.
Yeah.
It's entertaining. Also, yeah, it's very entertaining. They also do Scalia dirty in that. That really pisses me off. So
I remember you brought that up one time, yes.
Yeah.
They made him look kind of like, I don't know. They gave him like a shit-eating grin and like just looked like some like, you know, POS lawyer from like Manhattan or something.
Yeah. Well, they also just mischaracterized what unitary executive theory is. And that's the thing that really ticks me off. I mean, yeah, whoever casts people as Scalia is going to make him look like a fat ass. He was, but you know, that's not the thing that really.
Will you, Court, perhaps as the aspiring lawyer among us, you could set the record straight for us on the unitary executive theory.
Sure. So the way that, I'll start with this, the way that they act like, the way that they characterized unitary executive theory in that movie is, he's the president, he can do whatever he wants, he doesn't have to go through Congress or anything, there's no congressional checks on his power. That's nowhere close to the truth. What unitary executive theory means is that basically if your office is an executive office, then the president can fire you. Because sometimes the Senate will appoint like a special investigator. This happened during the Nixon administration, and there was a case called Morrison v. Olson that Scalia was the lone dissenter on. But if there's an executive office created, it's at the will and pleasure of the president. So that's all unitary executive theory is, and I think it's got strong constitutional backing. But it certainly doesn't mean that the presidency can do whatever they want.
It seems that then. That even that definition of unitary executive theory is not respected in practice very much, because it seems to me that the president can't exercise very much authority over a lot of those federal agencies, even though they're part of the executive branch nominally.
Yeah, no, that's true. But again, I mean, unitary executive theory isn't very widely held. He was the lone dissenter in Morrison v. Olson. He was the one person.
Yes.
And this is in like 2000. Or no, this is in like 93 or something like that.
I actually recall reading somewhere on the internet, from some blog somewhere, that there's an argument that the president is actually, in the White House is actually not the head of the executive branch, because we have effectively at this point a distributed executive branch spread throughout all those agencies. and the bureaucracy is the true chief executive of the country, and we have like a distributed executive.
Honestly, in practice, I wouldn't argue that too much.
No, but like de facto, that's what it is now.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm also no fan of the administrative state.
Right. Exactly.
Well, y'all, I try to keep these close to a half an hour. We've blown right on past that. But before we go, is there anything y'all would like to leave our listener with?
Make America Florida.
Yeah.
I guess. Only well, thing coming best... came to my mind.
I think that's the best way to end any podcast. Alec, Francois, thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure.
As Thank you always. So much for it.